Okay,
yeah, you were saying
go. Recorded live.
Oh, that's okay. You can wait.
Yeah, okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with another installment of the Christogenos Show with my co-host, Pastor Bill Fink. We've been doing a study on the book of Isaiah. We're actually quite farther along than I had anticipated. The last few chapters, we got as far as Isaiah chapter 24 and verse 17, I believe. Is that correct, Bill?
Yes.
And it turns out the last few chapters have been about judgments of various nations, some of them being Israelite nations, some being non-Israelite nations.
Well, this is, first we had the judgment of the surrounding nations, Egypt and
right.
Assyria and Babylon and Moab and Edom.
Right.
And then we had the judgment, the oracle of the desert of the sea, which we showed actually turned out to be Judah, right?
Right.
And now we have, in Isaiah 23, we have the burden of Tyre. And even though we're still in the middle of Isaiah chapter 24 now,
mm-hmm.
This is still the burden of Tyre.
Yeah.
And
right.
In chapter 25, it's still the burden of Tyre.
Okay.
So you know, people let the chapter divisions fool them into thinking that the subject changes.
Right.
And that's, we really have to cast aside the chapter divisions when we read the Bible, except when, when we need to make references to let other people know where things are.
Right.
But that's all the chapter divisions are good.
Right. But it's a good indication, too, of the fact that more time is spent on Tyre, Tarshish, Zidon, etc., which are, in fact, the Phoenicians.
Well, these are Israelite people.
Right.
And let me, I'm going to make a citation from Josephus.
Okay.
And this, he's not saying explicitly that Tyre is an Israelite city.
Right.
However, he's saying that Tyre is an Israelite city.
Right.
And this is from
the Israelites there, a lot of them.
Yeah.
Lots
yeah,
of,
well,
yeah.
Well, it's an Israelite city.
Mm-hmm.
It's a city in Asher's territory. Zebulun inhabited the mainland. The island city was built, according to Josephus, 240 years before the temple.
Okay.
When you examine that, we're right smack in the middle of the Judges period.
Right.
And it's building up to the peak of Israelite power.
Okay, well, here, let me just interject this, because every single tribe, except maybe one or two exceptions, I forget which tribe was the exception, they were all instructed to smite the Canaanites utterly and not leave one of them alive, okay? That was Yahweh's instruction to the Israelites, but none of them obeyed that. I forget which tribe may have actually carried that out to its completion. But what they did was they left a lot of Canaanites alive. And ultimately, as these Canaanites regrouped and mingled either on the outskirts of Israelite towns and cities, and sometimes mingled in those towns and cities, they finagled their way into our company again, as they always do, okay? And so my perception of what happened at Tyre, and because this is in the territory of Zidon, Jezebel came,
Well, right, but Tyre and Sidon are actually almost opposite ends of Asher's territory.
Okay, well, it's Asher's territory, okay. And Asher would have been one of those seafaring tribes, as were Zebulun and Gad and Dan, et cetera.
Right.
Okay.
And when you look at the accounts of where the Canaanites are left,
uh-huh.
Sidon is mentioned.
Yes.
Tyre is not mentioned.
Okay, okay. But as we mentioned last time, the Canaanites, one of the meanings of the word Canaanite is trafficker.
Oh, there's no doubt that
merchant.
Canaanites probably didn't get back into Tyre. There's no doubt whatsoever.
Right, right.
I mean, Canaanites drove, the Edomite Jews drove the British Empire.
Right, that's right.
And I would not doubt if they didn't drive
the
Phoenician Empire.
Exactly.
The merchants.
Exactly.
I don't doubt that one bit.
Yeah, that's the point I'm making. And so we're not to conceive of these nations as being overrun by Canaanites, but led by Canaanites, as typically they always do.
Well, I'm sure the Canaanite merchants were in the mix.
Yeah.
Just like Canaanite merchants were in the mix in Britain, in London, during the years of the Empire.
Right, and it was British / Israelite sailors who were sailing the ships of Britain, okay?
Well right, and a lot of
it wasn't Jews who were sailing those ships.
A lot of the businessmen, the merchants, were Britons and Saxons,
right,
but
exactly.
A great number of them were Jews.
Right.
And a lot of that, the financing that was going on for the Virginia Company and the East India Company and the Hudson Bay Company, that there were Jews behind a lot of that.
That's right. That's right. There's always Jewish money invested, you know, in the major enterprises, and it's always Israelites doing the work. That's the
Well, the patterns that we see today are the same patterns that have repeated themselves and repeated themselves.
Yes. And so knowing the perpetual relationship that our people have had with Canaanite / Edomite Jews, then, you know, it wouldn't be a stretch to assume that, and everything indicates that that's the way it was, okay? Now, before we actually get back into Isaiah chapter 24.
Let me cite this citation from Josephus.
Okay.
To show what I mean about the Tyrians.
Okay.
You know, Josephus is, and against Apion, he declares and against Apion, and this is, Section 22, Book 1, Section 22. And what is it? I lost my space. My space here.
Josephus,
I'm sorry. Was our nation unknown of old to several of the Grecian cities, and indeed was thought worthy of imitation by some of them. Now let me say that the Greeks were Israelites, but Josephus wasn't fully aware of that.
Yeah.
And there were people in Palestine that were. However, I think that the Pharisees and the Edomites had probably drowned a lot of that knowledge out by Josephus' time.
Yeah.
You know, because he's writing almost 250 years after the letter of Onias to Onias from the king of Sparta.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a long time. Now, Josephus says that several of the Grecian, our nation was not unknown to several of the Grecian cities, and indeed was thought worthy of imitation by some of them. This is declared by Theophrastus. Now, he lived in the 4th century BC. In his writings concerning laws, for he says that the laws of the Tyrians, and he could only have meant the island Tyre.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because the mainland city was destroyed when Theophrastus lived. Forbid men to swear foreign oaths, among which he enumerates some others, and particularly that called Corban, which oath can only be found among the Judeans, and declares what a man may call a thing devoted to God. And that Corban is even mentioned in the New Testament, right?
Okay, yes.
Nor indeed was Herodotus of Halicarnassus unacquainted with our nation, but mentions it after a way of his own. Now, Herodotus lived in the 5th century B.C.
Yeah.
When he said this in the second book concerning the Colchians, his words are these. The only people who were circumcised in their privy members were originally the Colchians, the Egyptians, the Ethiopians, which are the Cushites, and the Phoenicians and those Syrians that are in Palestine confess that they learned it from the Egyptians. Now that's Herodotus, and he interviewed people in Palestine almost 200 years, 150 years after the deportations of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that the accounts were confused by then, right?
Right, right.
That now Josephus admits here when Theophrastus talks about the Tyrians being, and their practices, Josephus is admitting that Tyre was an Israelite city.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, and then we have obvious evidence that when the Israelites partially, nearly exterminated the Canaanite population but didn't complete the job, that during that era, because the Phoenician era had to have followed right after that, okay? And the point I want to make here is a linguistic one. And the world of academia and the Jews themselves all insist that the Phoenicians invented the Phoenician script, right? But the Hebrews existed in the area at least for 2,000 years previous to the Phoenicians, okay? And they had a script of their own. What script did Moses write in, right? Okay. So the Hebrew script existed well before any Phoenician script. But the Phoenicians popularized it by being traders and bringing it all over the Mediterranean sea coasts, okay? So that the academics are absolutely wrong when they try to say that Phoenician preceded Hebrew. It's just ridiculous.
No, the Phoenicians are the Israelites who moved into that land with their script.
Right.
And right. It's the academics are taking a Jewish viewpoint that the Phoenicians must be different people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the Phoenicia is only a Greek word.
Right.
The word doesn't appear before the Greeks use it in Homer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the earliest known instances of the word.
Right.
You can't
right.
find one instance of the yes. word Phoenician that predates Homer.
Right, so the Phoenicians didn't exist before Homer.
well, no.
Roughly. I mean,
what I'm saying is that the Phoenicians, yet you know, they're never mentioned in ancient Egyptian inscription.
Right.
They didn't exist before the children of Israel moved into the land.
Yes, yes. So that the Phoenicians were the Tyrians and, you know, the Sidonians, who were probably, you know, anywhere 90%, above 90% Israelites. Had to be.
Well, right. Before the, you know, there's no record of the word Phoenician before the Greeks started using it of the inhabitants of Tyre and the Palestine coast.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, the records that do exist refer to various Canaanite cities and tribes.
Mm-hmm.
But that word Phoenician does not exist.
Right. And then in addition, the introduction of the name of Yahweh came in big time when the Israelites started, you know, exterminating the Canaanites. And that's when the people of Yahweh took over the territory.
And that's when Hebrew script supplanted cuneiform.
Right.
In those areas.
Right. Okay. Very good. Very good. So I just wanted to, you know, point out that the academics simply have this wrong. And the actual, you know, if you follow biblical history, it tells you that these Phoenicians, these Israelites who became Phoenicians, they obviously had to speak Hebrew and use Hebrew language well before they became Phoenicians. That's just the bottom line. You know, that's just logical. But since the academics believe the Jewish lie, that the Hebrews were hook-nosed kikes who couldn't have spoken the same language as the Aryans, right? But the Hebrews were Aryans. And
right, and the Phoenicians are described consistently as being blonde and fair.
Right. Very good. Very good. Okay, so with that understanding in mind, let's continue now. Isaiah chapter, actually, we were going to start with verse 17. But let me go back to verses 15 and 16. Wherefore glorify you, Yahweh, in the fires, even in the name of Yahweh, God of Israel, in the isles of the sea, okay?
Now, I'd like to give some historic background that this Tyre, this is the burden of Tyre.
Right.
Now, Herodotus said that even though Sidon was the more famous city in ancient times.
Right.
And it was.
Okay.
In pre-Homeric times, that all the Phoenician colonization into the Mediterranean came from Tyre.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Tyre.
Because that was the seaport.
Is the link. Well, so was Sidon. But Tyre became the more famous and more. I mean, look at little
famous.
Ireland.
It became more
look
famous.
At how many people poured out of Ireland.
Right.
Even though England's the more famous, you know, seaport.
Right.
The more famous seafaring nation, right?
Sure, sure.
Well, Tyre. Herodotus said that all the colonies in Phoenician colonies in the Mediterranean came from Tyre.
Okay.
And he made that statement explicitly.
Yeah.
And That you know, Tyre is the link between Israel and the people in the isles.
Yeah, Tarshish.
That right. Isaiah consistently mentions.
Tarshish, Ireland, Spain, England, exactly. Yes.
But, well, no, Sicily in Greece was a Phoenician colony. Thebes
okay.
in Greece was a Phoenician city. Miletus is the most famous of the Phoenician cities.
Right, that's northern
district.
Spain, right?
And no, it's not northern Spain.
No, it isn't?
No, there were Malaysians in Spain, that's true. They left by sea
yes.
and settled in Spain and in Ireland, that's true.
Right.
But that's not Miletus.
Okay, Miletus, so the original Miletus was...
The original Miletus is the most prominent city of southwestern Turkey.
Okay.
Southwestern Anatolia was a district called Caria. And all the records say that it was settled by Phoenicians.
Yes.
And Thales of Miletus is the most prominent of Greek of the earliest Greek philosophers.
Right.
And
right.
Herodotus calls him a Phoenician by race.
Okay.
Okay. Now the people of Miletus, not only did they send colonies into Spain and Ireland, but they colonized the entire Black Sea region.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes,
they had
direction.
Colonies all along the shores of the Black Sea, and they had colonies up and down the Danube.
Right.
So if you want to know how the Scots are came from Scythia but identified themselves as Malaysians,
well,
that would have to be how, because that's the only way that Malaysians could get from Scythia.
Right.
I
just put out a newsletter about that today.
I understand that. I didn't read it to see if you agreed with my
understanding. Well, Miles was one of those Phoenicians from Miletus. Okay. And apparently he took his name from Miletus. I like to pronounce it that way to keep the, but it doesn't really matter.
I don't know where they put the accent.
Miles, you know, is the way the English pronounce the name today, and it's spelled M-I-L-E-S, right? Miles. Miles decided to migrate west. On the way west, he stopped in Egypt, and this happened to be during the time period when Jeremiah had taken Zedekiah's daughters, Scotta and Tiatefi, to Egypt, okay? Miles wound up marrying Scotta. Miles and Scotta went to the Milesian colony in Spain, northern Spain. She bore him 6 sons, and then they intended to go to Ireland, but he died before he could make the trip. So Scotta, with her 6 sons and 2 other of Miles' sons by another woman, went to Ireland and conquered Ireland. And then an offshoot of those Irish Scots, you know, went to England and created Scotland.
Well, I don't know how literally I want to accept that, but I'm sure that the story represents, the facts of the migrations.
Right. But the point being that these people are Israelites. Okay? These people are Israelites. There's simply no doubt that they're Israelites. Okay?
Well, the Malaysians were. I mean, they were a portion of the Phoenicians.
Right.
It's very clear.
Yes. Yes.
And probably one of the most, one of the more prominent branches aside from the Carthaginians in the Mediterranean.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, very good. Very good. Okay, so, and then the other point I wanted to make about verse 15 here, it says, even the name of the Lord God of Israel. Okay, it's the God of Israel that we're talking about here, okay? And whenever we're talking about the God of Israel, we are his people. He's not talking about, it's not the God of the Tutus, it's not the God of the Chinamen, it's not the God of the Amerindians.
And the point to make here is that he's not the God of the Jews.
Right.
Because these people are Tyrians. They're Phoenicians.
Right.
And that they've never, the Jews deny any connection to them.
That's right. They still do today. Why should they?
And they have to in order to maintain their own false identity.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Now, it's true that the ancient Canaanites did worship Yahweh, but they worshiped 100 other gods as well. Okay. And their main god was Baal, not Yahweh. Okay. So, you know, it's like, how should I put this? Pagans will worship any god and every god to cover all the bases, right? Okay? They don't want to leave any gods out, so they make sure that one of those gods will eventually answer their prayers, right? That's paganism. But we, true Israelites, we only have one god, Yahweh. Okay? All right, here, let's go verse 16. From the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. But I said, my leanness, and my note here says, I waste away. Woe to me, the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. And this is a recurring theme throughout Scripture, both Old Testament and New Testament, that we have to beware of these treacherous people. And modern-day Judeo-Christianity simply pretends that evil has already been vanquished and we have nothing to worry about. And that's false. The evil ones are in total control of our society, and because Christians have let their guard down, they can't see it. They simply accept their slavery as if it were freedom. Okay? All right, verse 17. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon you, O inhabitant of the earth, indeed they are. And it shall come to pass that he who flees from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit.
Now there, right there, I would like to say right there, the Christian should fear nothing.
Right, right. I mean, exactly. If they know Yahweh, they should be absolutely fearless.
He
right.
that flees from the noise of the fear is gonna stumble.
Right, right.
He's gonna fall
yeah.
into the pit.
Yeah. But there's two ways. If you are, let's say, you don't have any fear because you don't know there's any danger. Okay.
Well, here you definitely hear the noise of the fear.
Right.
I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
clear to me.
Yeah. And he that comes up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare, for the windows from on high are open and the foundations of the earth do shake. So, in other words, those Israelites who have abandoned Yahweh, they'd have a real good reason to fear. Okay. And that's where most of our people are at. Verse 19. The earth is utterly broken down, but many of them, the modern Judeo-Christians, have a false sense of security because they believe that the struggle is over. Verse 19, the earth is utterly broken down, the earth is clean dissolved, the earth is moving exceedingly, and I think, you know, we can take this in both senses, that the planet and the local earth, there's all kinds of turmoil. Verse 20, and this one really sounds like it's talking about the whole planet.
Well, right, but I think it's being metaphoric. It's poetic
sure.
license, and it's talking about the tumult that's occurring in the land.
Right, right. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard and shall be removed like a cottage. And, of course, we can talk here about tectonic plates, right? And the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. So some mountains fell and never rose again.
Well, ancient Tyre was destroyed, and
right.
after it was destroyed, it never rose again.
Right.
It was never rebuilt.
Right, yeah. And the same thing is true of Babylon, the city of Babylon, anyway. Verse 21, and it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high and the kings of the earth upon the earth. Now, this one definitely seems to be pretty much pinpointing the judgment day. Of course, Yahweh punishes these kingdoms throughout history when he's through with them.
Well, as you read 23, I have some comments.
Okay, let me read 22 and 23. And they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days shall they be visited. Then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed when Yahweh of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously.
Now, the moon is going to be confounded, right?
Right.
The moon doesn't have shame.
Mm-hmm.
The sun is going to be ashamed.
Right.
Keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
The moon and the sun, yeah, you know, a lot of people take these symbols literally.
Yeah.
Well, like the moon will turn his blood. They're waiting for the moon to turn into blood, right?
Right, right.
Well, the moon and the sun, in prophecy, they're symbols of temporal power.
Right.
Okay. And Matthew 24:29, I'm going to read it immediately after the tribute, and that's pointing to the end time,
right.
And so is this section of Isaiah.
Right.
And we're going to get into that a lot in deeper in the next chapter, because it's still
okay.
talking about Tyre in chapter 25.
Right.
That
right.
Now, Matthew 24:29, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. That now the stars are the children of Israel,
right?
And that's consistent in prophecy, and that starts the first. Yeah, you know, Abraham's seed will be like the stars of heaven, and Deborah said that the stars of heaven fought, you know, in the battles against the Canaanites
mm-hmm.
in Judges chapter 5. So that symbology goes back quite a long time.
Sure.
Now
yeah, it goes back to Joseph actually.
The sun and the moon shall not give light. Let me. Quote Revelation 21:23.
Okay.
This is talking about the city of God, you know, after it's all said and done with. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it. For the glory of Yahweh did
mm-hmm.
light.
Yes.
That's
yes.
pointing to a time when the temporal powers on earth,
right.
the governments of man, are no longer necessary.
Right.
It doesn't mean we're not going to have a physical sun anymore.
Right.
And a physical moon.
Yeah.
It means that Yahweh will again be king.
Right. In our hearts.
Okay, well, yeah, but in the de facto king
right?
Well, like he was back in the days of the Exodus.
Right, right.
And, well, and you know, up until the time that the children of Israel forsook him.
Right, exactly.
And his word doesn't rule anymore, and he's not king anymore, and he hasn't been.
Yeah.
And for that, we've been punished for how many thousands of years.
And Paul clearly says that our bodies are the physical temples of the kingdom, right? And not buildings built out of bricks and mortar, okay? Yeah, so the symbolism is that we are the kingdom.
Now, I would like to talk a little more about the sun and the moon.
Okay, sure.
It's evident that the sun and the moon are used to represent these things, and also all throughout the ancient pagan Adamic world, the sun was used to represent the true and high God.
Mm-hmm.
And an example is the Egyptian Amon. Okay, that's probably one of the most primary examples.
Right.
And even the ancient Assyrians equated the sun with Baal. And that's how we get the Bel worship and sun worship in Ireland.
Okay.
Ireland.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The sun, Bel became, Bel, which means Lord, became equated with the sun.
Okay.
So Yahweh takes advantage of that symbolism that men invented, right?
Right.
Now the moon is sometimes represented as the so-called queen of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not all the time. Okay. In many of the ancient cultures, the moon was also a god.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the Kenite. The Kenite moon god Sin,
right.
Which is actually called Sin.
Sin, right.
And probably where the English translators got the word from.
Right, the great whore.
When they wanted to describe something evil, right? They
she
called
was
it
the great
Sin.
Whore, exactly.
Now, here on Earth, I believe we have representatives of both so-called deities.
Right.
You know, the sun and the moon. And the children of the sun are the children of the true God.
Mm-hmm.
And the children of the moon are the Kenite, Edomite, Canaanite powers. That's
the
way I look at it.
They have a lunar calendar, too.
That's why the moon shall be confounded, and the sun will not give its light.
Yes, yes. Well, here, let's carry this
and the sun will be ashamed. The sun, you know, the people of Yahweh should be ashamed.
Yes, absolutely.
And the moon, the people of the enemy,
right.
The power of the enemy that has corrupted all of our governments.
They have no shame.
They have no shame.
They have no shame, yeah. And and those of us who have understanding are ashamed of our own sins and the sins of our people, but those true Israelites who haven't awakened yet, they're not ashamed yet because they're not aware of what they're involved in. They're not aware of what they're allowing to take place in the name of Jesus Christ and in the name of Yahweh. They don't understand it, okay? Let me carry the metaphor a little further. Revelation chapter 12, verse 1. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet.
Right, exactly.
Okay? The Jews will finally be under our feet. And upon her head, a crown of 12 stars. What do you think that number 12 stands for? Okay. And
it's
the 12 tribes of Israel, of course, right.
Well, it's all basically the same symbology.
Right, right. And she being with child cried, travailing in birth, in pain to be delivered. Now, this could be the literal birth of Jesus Christ by Mary. It could be the bringing forth into reality the United States of America after the seven times. And it can also represent the coming of the kingdom in Revelation chapter 21. Okay.
Now, what's the symbolization? What's the biggest symbol in Islam?
The moon, the crescent moon.
That's
right.
The sign of the devil.
Right, exactly, exactly. So Judaism, Islam, all these false religions will finally be conquered when our people wake up and when Yahshua comes back to, you know, claim his bride. That's the way it's going to work, folks. Right? Isn't that the symbolism? And, of course, the Judeo-Christian world really despises this symbolism because they're in bed with the Jews.
Well, in the end, there'll be no Judaism and no Islam because there'll be no Jews and no Muslims.
Right, that's right, because all the half-breeds will be out of business. Okay. All right, so where were we? We're at chapter 25.
Yes.
Okay, here we go, verse 1. O Yahweh, you are my Elohim. I will exalt you. I will praise your name, for you have done wonderful things. Your counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. And we're supposed to be faithful and true in return. Verse 2, for you have made a city a heap. of a defensed city, a ruin, a palace of strangers, to be no city. It shall never be built. You probably want to back up this historically, right, Bill?
Well, right.
Tyre, you want me to continue reading?
No, Tyre never was rebuilt. And Alexander, when it wasn't given to Nebuchadnezzar to destroy the island city.
Uh-huh.
And it was the same Nebuchadnezzar that tore down Jerusalem and the temple, tore down the mainland city of Tyre.
Right.
And that happened right around the same time or within a year of the time Jerusalem was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that city laid there in a heap of ruin for 250 years, and Alexander the Great came,
mm-hmm.
and the Canaanites and the people that were left, the ancient trailer trash, perhaps,
right?
That they never even picked up the city. It just laid there a wreck.
Right. Yeah,
nobody wanted
it.
To mess with it, and we see that, you know, with the same riffraff today, they don't build anything.
Right.
That they're quick to move into something that's not theirs, but they don't build anything.
Well, yeah, we're seeing like in South Africa, after they're killing all the white farmers who built up South Africa, they're not building anything. All they're doing is destroying.
Well, and Alexander the Great came and he wanted to get out to the island city and conquer it, and he used the rubble from the mainland city to fill in a rampart and a causeway,
mm-hmm.
and it's only a couple of hundred yards from what I understand.
Okay.
In the ancient accounts. And he filled it in with the rubble from that city.
Right.
And had his men take all that rubble and push it into the sea and dump it into the sea and build it and make a foundation for his causeway.
Right. He built giant ramparts on wheels.
Yes, and he actually connected the mainland to
the
island.
He built the causeway so he could roll the ramparts on wheels toward the wall. I understand a couple of those ramparts were burned, and he built more, and he eventually conquered the city that way. Yeah.
Right. And after the city, I don't think it's in Isaiah. It might be in Ezekiel. Tyre will be scraped clean like the top of a rock. And it was.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing left to it when they were done. They destroyed that city. It's actually under the water now by about 6 feet, I think.
Okay.
What would have been the ancient island of Tyre.
Uh-huh.
Okay. From what I understand, it's under the water now.
Yeah.
The Mediterranean, the sea level has risen since then.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Very good. All right. So verse 3, therefore shall the strong people glorify you, the city of the terrible nations shall fear you. Okay. Of the ruthless nations shall fear you. Is he talking about the Israelites here? Because obviously the Tyrians were no longer feared after this destruction. So he must be here referring to Alexander. Okay.
Well, he might be talking about, oh, Lord.
Well,
thou hast made a heap of the city, a defense city, a ruin, a palace of strangers. Shall be no city, it shall never be built.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore shall strong people
glorify you,
glorify thee.
The city of the terrible nations.
Maybe
this is referring to a future rebirth of Tyrian commerce, okay, but not the actual city of it.
Therefore shall the poor people bless thee, and cities of injured men shall bless thee. And I think that Yahweh himself is talking about that Isaiah is talking about Yahweh himself.
Okay.
For thou hast made a city of a heap.
Right.
Isaiah is talking to Yahweh. Yahweh is the subject of this sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, strong
verse
people shall glorify Yahweh because of the destruction of Tyre.
Okay. So verse 3 is saying, because you have destroyed Tyre, that the Israelites will glorify you.
Well, yes.
In
Let
other
me
words.
Read
okay.
The NIS is, therefore a strong people will glorify thee, meaning Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Isaiah is addressing Yahweh here.
Yeah.
Oh, Yahweh, thou art my God. I will exalt thee, praise thy name. You've destroyed Tyre, and now as a strong people are going to glorify you for that.
Yes, yes.
And the city of the terrible nations, and the NAS has their cities of ruthless nations will revere thee.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, even the worst hominids,
right,
are awed by the majesty of God when something tremendous like that happens.
Right, and Ezekiel has a similar thought that the nations of the world will understand that we are his people, Israel, after he performs his vengeance. Okay? So this is a similar thought here. Okay, verse 4. For you have been a strength to the poor, a strength to the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shadow from the heat, when the blast of the terrible ones is a storm against the wall. Okay, so Yahweh is our strength, folks. Verse 5.
Well, right. And part of the lesson there, I think, is that every huge and powerful city, like Tyre, becomes like we know what London and New York are.
Yes.
They become oppressive to the people of the nation.
Right.
Look at the taxes that are demanded by New York City on the rest of the people of the state.
Right.
And of the country as a whole. And and the resources that New York City demands. And it's become, big cities become oppressive to their neighbors.
Right. That's right. Very good. Okay, verse 5. You shall bring down the noise of the strangers as the heat in a dry place, even the heat with the shadow of a cloud. The branch of the terrible ones shall be brought low, or the ruthless ones. And in this mountain shall Yahweh of hosts make to all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, L-E-E-S. What is a lee? Dregs? Strong wine? I get it. A feast of wines. What do they make out of the bottom of the barrel? They make either some kind of liqueur out of the bottom of the barrel. I forget what they call it.
Brandy?
Maybe
I don't
brandy.
Know. Maybe brandy or
yeah.
I don't know. I got a few more notes here. You know, ancient Tyre, I believe, has its parallel in New York City today.
Right.
Well, Manhattan is an ancient, just like the ancient island city of Tyre.
Right.
Manhattan
is an island city.
It's an island.
Right.
It's very close to the neighboring shores.
Right.
And it's built upon a rock.
Uh-huh.
Just like ancient
Tyre. Right.
And just like ancient Tyre.
New York
its boundaries,
Tyre.
Really.
Right.
Its boundaries have stretched to encompass other cities from the neighboring shores.
Yes.
Which have been incorporated into it.
Right.
But like Brooklyn was its own city in the 1800s.
Yeah.
In fact, it was the fourth largest city in the country at that time.
Yeah. I wonder if it had twin towers, ancient Tyre.
Yeah. And just like ancient Tyre, New York is the premier mercantile city of its age.
Right.
The heat of a cloud description.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That it would be as the heat that thou shalt bring down the noise of strangers. New York's filled with aliens.
Yes.
As the heat in a dry place, even the heat with the shadow of a cloud. Now, what kind of heat comes from a cloud?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and let me read Matthew 24:9. The heat of a cloud description put together with Matthew 24:29, which says, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened,
mm-hmm.
and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven shall be shaken.
Yeah.
And this seems to indicate to me just how the destruction, its destruction shall take place, and it doesn't forebode well.
Right, right. Well, I mean, the heat with the shadow of a cloud.
Sounds like a mushroom cloud to me.
That's, right, yeah, either that, you know, and it could be a volcanic as well, as they're experiencing in Iceland right now. Yeah. So
well right, but I mean, the heat of a cloud and the powers of heaven, that word, the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. That
right.
word is Uranos, or the same word that we get uranium from.
Right.
That's pretty
right. Okay, yeah, and that's a terrible thought, Bill.
well, yeah, it is. But that's, you know what, I see this in the end time applied to today.
Yeah.
And if you want to see Babylon fall,
right.
I see this. I have to.
Right. Well, we've all been conditioned, at least recently, to think that New York is going to be destroyed by a tidal wave. But, you know, it could be after the atomic
explosion. Yeah, well, that might clean it up.
Right.
Right. And this is definitely an end-time prophecy.
Yes.
And it's pretty foreboding. That's all.
Yeah, it doesn't look good for the terrible ones here, the ruthless ones. And, indeed, New York City is filled with ruthless Jews.
Now, verse 6 will show even more that this is an end-time
okay,
prophecy.
Well, yeah, let's get into it again.
Verses 6 and 7.
Right. And okay, I'll read both 6 and 7. And in this mountain shall Yahweh of hosts make to all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees well refined, like Brandy, and he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering cast over all people, and the veil of that is spread over all the nations. Okay, comment.
This is definitely an end-time prophecy.
Right.
None of this happened at any time in the past, so it must be talking about this age we're in now. The
right.
covering over all people is the global deception perpetrated by Satan.
It's talking about
mostly
Babylon.
Through the Jewish-controlled media
right.
and religions, which is the same deception discussed in Revelation chapter 20.
Yes.
And New York
18, 19, and 20, right.
New York City is the capital of that deception.
That's right.
And it's related, you know, after the deception is destroyed and the Babylon is brought down, Yahweh makes a feast for his people.
Right, right.
That's the wedding supper of the
yeah.
Lamb.
Yeah, well, even though the Rothschilds are based in the city of London, the fact is, because I want to back up what you're saying here, the fact is that the United Nations, which is a Rothschild creation, is placed in New York City, right? The United Nations and the Federal Reserve Bank, both located in New York City, are the means by which the world is controlled. Okay? That's and for some reason they picked those two twin towers, I guess because they're in the neighborhood. And, you know, since they're already in the neighborhood, you know, they're very, very familiar with the territory.
Well, they just I can't understand how they destroyed two Canaanite phallic symbols.
Yeah, right.
I don't get.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, well, to blame it on the Arabs, you know, that's, you know, we could probably discuss that in length, you know, all the symbolism there. But it's real obvious that the main island of the international Jew is New York City, Manhattan. Simply no doubt about it. Okay.
Now, the next verse absolutely proves my interpretation here that this is all, you know, end-time prophecy.
Right, right.
And what this is talking about, because it says he will swallow up death in victory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
okay.
quoted by Paul at 1 Corinthians 15, 54, and 55.
Okay, let me read the verse, and then you can dig up the citations here. He will swallow up death in victory. And Yahweh Elohim will wipe away tears from off all faces. And again, this is a very revelatory in both senses of the word. And the rebuke of his people shall he take away from off all the earth, for Yahweh has spoken it. And yeah, it says my notes here are Revelation 21:4, 1 Corinthians 15:54.
Absolutely. Paul quotes it and John quotes it.
Did you want to quote those two?
Well, no, I wasn't planning on it,
you
but
were
I just wanted to make the citation, yes.
Oh, okay.
And,
right.
and that shows that this that our interpretation of this as an end-time prophecy.
Right.
It unfolds. It's extremely clear.
Yes. Okay, verse 9. And it shall be said in that day, lo, this is our Elohim. We have waited for him, and he will save us. This is Yahweh. We have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. Well, those of us who understand what's going on, we can't wait, you know.
Well, let me say, too, that the more sensible Christians who believe these words
mm-hmm.
are derided by those people of vanity for having this attitude.
Right.
You know, the armchair warriors that attempt to provoke us into premature, vain, senseless action.
Right. Yeah.
They don't read this verse. They must skip over it.
Yeah,
and there's other verses like it.
Right.
However, it's clear to me that we can't do this by ourselves, and we're not going to be alone.
Well, yeah, the Revelation says, "Who can make war against the beast?"
Right.
We're certainly in no position to make war against the beast. So we have to put our faith in Yahweh. You know, we really have no other choice. That doesn't mean we shouldn't organize and you know protect ourselves, and you know, but primarily. What we should do is alert other Israelites to what's happening so that they don't get caught in the maelstrom here, you know, because just as Yahshua warned the Judahites that when they see Jerusalem compassed by armies, flee to the mountains, okay? And when Titus brought off the attack for one day, I think it was only one day.
No, it was longer than that.
It was longer than that?
Yeah, it was a lot longer than that.
Okay.
It was maybe a year.
Oh, really? A year?
I'm being honest, yes. It was there was a good space of time. in between the withdrawal of Cestius and the coming
right.
of Titus.
And that's when the Christian Judahites fled to Pella and points north, okay, to get out of Judea, which was ultimately, and that's when the temple was ultimately destroyed, okay? So all of these ancient and near prophecies that we're talking about, they're pointing to this judgment day, you know, and we've had several, you know, we've had Tyre being destroyed, we've had the Jerusalem destroyed, we've had Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed, all for the same reason, because evil has been flourishing there, and our people have been going along with it. Okay? I mean, how many times do our people have to go through this before they learn? Okay? Verse 9, and it shall be in, oh, okay, I just read that. Verse 10, for in this mountain shall the hand of Yahweh rest, and Moab shall be trodden down under him, even as straw is trodden down for the dunghill. It reminds me, Pastor Greg one time pointed out that there are still Moabites around with us here. Or do you think this is just symbolically Moab here?
Oh, there are. I think it represents probably the wider Arab world, or at least a good swath of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And we're invaded by them now.
Right. Okay, verse 11. Yeah, because Moab was those mixed people, could probably equate those people with Arabs. Verse 11, and he shall spread forth his hands in the midst of them, as he that swims spreads forth his hands to swim, and he shall bring down their pride together with the spoils of their hands. Now, actually, this point brings home the idea that the Arabs may be meant by Moab here, because what are they doing? With very great pride, they are establishing their religion in Britain, and they're trying to do so here as well. Verse 12, and the fortress of the high fort of your walls he shall bring down, lay low, and bring to the ground, even to the dust. So, folks, these prophecies, we have to take these seriously. You know, and unfortunately, the Judeo-Christian world has been duped by this rapture theory that they won't have to go through this. But even Paul says, that the tribulation is necessary. Tribulation.
Well, over and over again. And another thing I'd like to say about these last couple of verses is that, in the places where Isaiah talks about the wolf lying down with the lamb, that certainly does not infer universalism, that those verses have to be interpreted in a different method.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Yeah. And they're very specific images. They're not universal images. Yeah, exactly. Chapter 26, verse 1. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. Now, that's not the Israeli state, folks. Judah is where we are. The land of Judah is where Judah is.
Yeah, you know, this verse here in 26:1, this verse ruins the false interpretations of the anti-Judah clowns like Troublemaker and those.
Right. Right, exactly. Because, yeah, who's singing the song? Well, the Judahites, being primarily Germans, and being of the house of David, the royal house of David that's strewed throughout the European monarchies, okay, still exists. There's still good Judahites out there. Maybe not too many. There's a few. Okay.
Oh, I'm sure there's a lot.
Yeah, okay. So the land of Judah is not talking about ancient Judea. The land of Judah is where the Judahites are. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. And, of course, this word salvation here, because the modern churches always talk about this as spiritual salvation. We're talking about the literal salvation of the literal people.
And this to me indicates that, that no matter how many of our cities the Canaanites and the Edomites sink their claws into and corrupt, like they must have corrupted ancient Tyre, that the people of God will always have a strong city,
yes,
and salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks.
Right. Yeah,
that's what this is saying.
Yeah,
but let them have New York, let them have Miami, let them have San Francisco.
Right, because there's always a remnant of people who refuse to do business with the Canaanites.
Right, yes. Absolutely.
Verse 2, open you the gates that the righteous nation which keeps the truth may enter in. You will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on you because he trusts in you. Okay, that's That's us, folks. That's Christian Israel. The Judeo-Christian world does not believe in Yahweh. The Jews teach that you shouldn't even pronounce his name. Of course, they have no right to because they're not Israelites. Verse 3, you will keep, verse 4, trust you in Yahweh forever. For in the Yahweh Jehovah, here's another instance of the word Yahweh being twice.
Right. The other instance that we talked about a couple of weeks ago was in chapter 12, verse 2.
Okay.
And this is actually just like that.
Mm-hmm.
It says, forever, for in Yahweh
okay.
is everlasting strength.
Okay. So the first
verse. And it should probably be a comma. If I was translating this, I would put a comma between
right.
Yah
yeah, that would
Yahweh.
Make more sense.
And,
yeah.
and it would it just makes the appeal to Yahweh emphatic.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Very good. Verse 5, for he brings down them that dwell on high, the lofty city, he lays it low. He lays it low even to the ground. He brings it even to the dust. So in other words, all of these previous chapters where he's talking about the judgment of these other nations and these other cities, really, you know, the headquarter cities of these nations. And now this one is prophetic. We're talking about
prophetic. And I think it's still talking about New York.
Right. Exactly.
I can't help but make that correlation. It's clear to me. I mean,
right.
I don't like to stick my neck out there.
Yeah.
You know, with prophecy and say this is going to happen or that's going to happen.
You're saying
but
you're conservative?
that these chapters are so clearly describing
the
preeminent city of the modern Babylonian system.
Exactly. And these verses here in chapters, you know, 24, 25, and 26 so far, they're so well correlated with Revelation 18 and 19 where it talks about the destruction of Mystery Babylon.
Well, absolutely. And even though ancient Babylon, you know, this the Canaanite system was developed and
mm-hmm.
perfected there.
Right.
But it was practiced in Tyre.
Right.
It was practiced in Venice. It was practiced in London.
Yeah.
It's practiced everywhere they go.
Yeah.
Everywhere they infiltrate, they bring it with them.
Yeah.
And today, New York is their capital.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And New York is the Tyre of the modern world.
That's right. The correlation between these verses and the book of Revelation talking about the destruction of Mystery Babylon are perfect. You know, you really can't, if you have read both accounts, you can't mistake the similarities. Okay, verse 6. The foot shall tread it down, even the feet of the poor and the steps of the needy. Now, it's interesting that this it says this because you know, look around the world, all the rich Jews, all the billionaire Jewish bankers, and they can't even set up a home for the needy, for the homeless.
No, the only time they do that is when some Jew starts a charity,
yeah.
and they give him a few billion dollars,
right.
but only pennies of that trickle down to the people that
right
that
and
they
and
claim
his charity,
to be.
Right, and his Jewish banker buddies give him millions of dollars.
Right. I would love to enumerate the charities started by Jews.
Uh-huh, okay.
And how many charities there are in the world, and how many of them are run and founded by Jews.
Right.
And I bet they got like 90% of them.
Right, right.
And that would make them look like the most charitable people in the world.
Yes.
But all they do is they set up charities to be official parasite entities.
They
are.
It's a cash cow. For a
yes,
guy who runs the charity.
It guarantees every Jew a job. Just start a charity.
Right, exactly. I've worked for that kind of company. I know exactly what you're talking about. I can even name them.
I wouldn't give one penny to an organized charity.
Right.
If you have to give money away, find a young woman in your neighborhood that's a single mother that has a white baby swinging from her hip.
Right.
And give it to her.
Well, I can give you a perk. I did some electrical repairs for a charity on Sheffield Avenue that, you know, was stuck in the back. You couldn't see it from the front. And there was mixed race people everywhere, right? And a Jew was running it.
Well, right. That's what they do. Jews want jobs.
Yeah.
And they can't get, you know, they can't get in at Goldman Sachs. They start charities.
Yeah. And it's all tax exempt, you know, and he pays himself a big salary from all the donations that come in. And, you know, basically what he does is he brings a lot of neighborhood kids in and gives them crayons and paper, right? that's what it is.
Yeah, you know, my old man has a few New York, this periodical. It's called New York Outdoor News.
Okay.
And it's a sportsman's newspaper type format thing, and it comes out every other week here.
Yeah.
And it keeps track of all the sporting organizations and the
right.
hunting seasons, the fishing seasons, and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of the New York chapter of the some kind of what turkey federation.
Right.
Yeah, you know, something to do with wild turkeys, right?
Yeah.
$400,000 a year.
Yeah. Wow.
Salary.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Right.
I couldn't believe it when I saw that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I'll count all the turkeys for $400,000.
Right.
I mean.
Well, yeah, like another scam like in San Diego, it's not exactly a charity, but yeah, in fact it is because the San Diego County threatened to take all the crosses down in some cemetery, okay? So a local group of Christians got together to protest, and guess what? A couple of Jews took over the whole organization, okay? So they can pretend to be, you know, opposed to taking down all these crosses. But in reality, they were just collecting money to make and making themselves look good by fronting for a charity, right? Or for, you know, what seemed to be a sincere protest group, you know? That's how the Jews operate, folks. They're just conniving, devious people, okay? Verse 7, the way of the just is uprightness. You, most upright, do weigh the path of the just, okay? So those of us who are, oh, okay, we're talking about Yahweh again still, right, okay. I can't forget the context. Don't want to become a snatching, a verse snatcher. Verse 8, yea, in the way of your judgments, O Yahweh, have we waited for you. The desire of our soul is to your name and to the remembrance of you. Now, it's interesting to me, again, your name, and his name is not God, okay? His name is Yahweh, and the modern Judeo-Christians still don't get it. Verse 9, with my soul have I desired you in the night. Yea, with my spirit within me will I seek you early, for when your judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness.
They will have no choice.
Right. Well, Revelation says that he will rule with a rod of iron. Indeed, they will have no choice. Let favor be showed to the wicked, yet will he not learn righteousness. Okay.
No, it's genetic.
Yeah. Well, Bill, have the race-mixing churches of Southern Africa, have they learned anything?
None of them have learned anything. Look at what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
None of them have,
yeah.
can possibly learn anything.
They've tried to show righteousness to these blacks, try to make them into Christians, and they hack the Christians to pieces once they get back into power. As Jesus says, you know, casting out pearls before swine, lest they turn again and rend you. The message is the same, folks. It's the modern churches who have distorted the message and pretend that Jesus loves everybody. Okay? In the land of uprightness will he deal unjustly and will not behold the majesty of Yahweh. He will simply not do it. So stop trying. Yahweh, when your hand is lifted up, they will not see. But they shall see and be ashamed for their envy at the people. Yea, the fire of your enemies shall devour. So it sounds to me like this verse is saying, they, you know, these blacks in South Africa who are murdering whites who have been so generous and kind to these black people, and the same thing is happening to our people in America. We're giving all our tax money to these lazy blacks who aren't doing anything with the money that are being given by the government. They're not building
anything. Well, the Jews scraping about 90% off the top of that, too.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
You know, I mean, the cost of bureaucracy,
yeah.
it probably outweighs the benefits sure. that anybody receives.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. So the vipers are skimming off the top, and even who's the Jewish economist admitted that that's the way the system really works, okay?
It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Well, when a Jew wants a job and he can't found a charity, he goes and becomes a bureaucrat.
Right. Exactly, yeah, and that's why you see so many Jews in bureaucratic positions in our government, state, local, and federal, right? So it says here, at least some of these, non-white wicked will be ashamed for their envy at us because we haven't done them wrong. They're blaming us for everything the Jews are doing wrong. Verse 12, Yahweh, you will ordain peace for us for you also have wrought all our works in us. O Yahweh, our Elohim, other lords beside you have had dominion over us, but by you only will we make mention of your name. They are dead. And let me just stop here and comment, because one of the main vices, one of the main sins that the northern ten tribes committed was taking Yahweh's name in blasphemy. They were blaspheming his name, and he got tired of it. So I'm gonna cast you out because you're blaspheming my name. Verse 14, they are dead. They shall not live. They are deceased. They shall not rise. Therefore have you visited and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish. Verse 15, you have increased the nation, O Yahweh. You have increased the nation. You are glorified. You have removed it far to all the ends of the earth. There's the dispersion again, folks. Verse 16, Yahweh, in trouble have they visited you. They poured out a prayer when your chastening was upon them. Okay, and obviously it's been the experience of our house, our stiff-necked house of Israelites, that whenever we get into trouble, that's when we turn back to Yahweh.
Right. It seems to be human nature, right?
Right.
People don't pray until they're in danger.
Right, until they're in danger. Right. They lose contact with their Creator because things are going too well. And they assume that they're the author of their prosperity and totally forget Yahweh. Yeah.
And let me say that it's absolutely no mistake that the English word crisis, which is used when something bad happens,
mm-hmm.
that's the same exact word as the Greek word krisis, which is judgment.
Uh-huh.
That's what it means.
Right.
And that's where we got it from.
Yeah. Yeah.
When a calamity comes upon you, it's a crisis. That's
right.
A judgment.
It's a judgment. Right. Very good. Very good. Verse 17, like as a woman with child that draws near the time of her delivery is in pain and cries out in her pangs, so have we been in your sight, O Yahweh. And now, of course, this is definitely, obviously, it's a metaphor. However, I think it's more than, I look at it almost literally, because when Paul talks about the day when the whole creation groans in travail for the coming of the sons and daughters of Yahweh, that's, we're literally going to be changed overnight and given our immortal bodies, okay?
And even Christ, in John chapter 16, makes the same metaphor.
Okay.
Verily, verily, I say unto you that ye shall weep and lament, and the world shall rejoice,
mm-hmm.
and you shall be sorrowful. But your sorrow shall be turned into joy.
Right.
When a woman, when she is in travail, has sorrow because
yeah.
her hour is come. But
yeah.
as soon as she is delivered of the child, she remembers no more the anguish.
Right. And that's another verse that just demolishes the rapture theory. Because it's saying that the Israelites will have to go through the travail.
Right, and this is the travail, and we
yes.
mourn in anguish now, but we will rejoice when the time
right.
is fulfilled.
That's right.
There is no doubt.
Yes, yes. And that's why our faith is being tested, Israelites. It's being tested. Okay, verse 18. We have been with child. We have been in pain. We have, as it were, brought forth wind.
I don't think he means that kind of wind.
That's a cosmic joke. We have not wrought any deliverance in the earth, neither have the inhabitants of the world fallen. All right, yeah, well, not quite yet. We're waiting. We're waiting. Oh, man, running out of patience. Verse 19, your dead men shall live. Together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing that you dwell in the dust. Oh, you that dwell in the dust. For your dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. And, of course, we're talking here Ezekiel's metaphor of a dead man's bones. Verse 20, come, my people, enter you into your chambers and shut your doors about you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment, until the indignation be overpassed. Again, the warning of Yahshua to flee to the mountains.
Right. This is an admonition to separate ourselves from
right.
this evil world.
Right.
In some way, I mean, we
yeah.
we have to separate ourselves from all the things that the the majority of people are partaking in that is idolatrous, adulterous, lustful, and yet, you know, the casinos, the movie houses, the sporting events, the Jew porno parlors, the gambling halls. Well, we got to stay away from all that.
Yes.
The bar rooms, the clubs, that's, you know, we are not to party with the devil.
Yeah, right.
The financial system.
Yeah.
It's anything that's connected to Mystery Babylon we should flee from.
Right. I guess there's somebody in the chat room saying that the Jews are God's chosen people. Oh, no, they're not. Show me one Jew that obeys the law of Moses. Find me one Jew that obeys the law of Moses. There is no such animal. If you think there is, you don't know about the Talmud. You don't know about what the Jews really teach. Okay, so please disabuse yourself of that idea. It's not true. Verse 21, for behold, Yahweh comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. Oh, he's going to forgive us all. Isn't that what the televangelists say? He's going to forgive us all. The earth also shall disclose her blood. Like the blood that Cain spilled?
Now this again is still an end time prophecy.
Right. Absolutely.
And shall no more cover her slain. And and I have Revelation 20, verses 12 to 15 here. And,
yes.
And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before Yahweh, and the books were open, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which are written in the books according to their works.
Yes.
And the sea gave up the dead which were in it.
Mm-hmm.
And death and hell were delivered. And death and hell, and hell is the pit also.
Right.
In Hebrew, that's the metaphor, delivered up the dead which were in them.
Yes. Okay, so folks, we have to take this Judgment Day business very, very seriously. And Greg reminds me that, just seeing his name, that the book of Enoch very clearly says that our oppressors will be the rich. Our oppressors will be the rich.
Well, you know, even James says that.
Yes.
James chapter 2 says that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That the wealthy, why would you, you know, he talks about the respect of the status of persons in James chapter 2.
Right.
And he challenges people, why do you prefer, give preference to the wealthy when they're the ones that rule over and oppress you?
Right. Deuteronomy 28, the alien that is within you shall lend to you, and you shall not lend to him. Who's doing the lending? It surely ain't
right.
Us.
That's one of the marks of our disobedience.
That's right. The punishment. It's one of the curses. Absolutely. All right. Chapter 27, verse 1. In that day, Yahweh with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent. Serpent, folks. Wasn't that a serpent in Genesis chapter 3? Even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, the one with the crooked nose, the crooked eyes, the crooked lips, and the crooked mind, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea.
Now why would Yahweh punish a sea creature?
Right.
the race of Satan.
That's
is
right.
The dragon in the sea.
Uh-huh.
The sea is the general mass of people. No
right.
matter who they are, Adamite, non-Adamite, all together we make up the sea, right?
Right.
Like the net that's cast into the sea, and it pulls out good fish and bad, and that's the kingdom of heaven.
Right.
And the bad fish are left up to dry rot on the shore.
Exactly.
And the good fish are gathered.
Right.
All right? That's, you know, the sea is the general mass of people, both good and bad,
yeah.
and there's a dragon in it.
That's right.
And that dragon is the serpent.
Right.
And it's the adversary. That's Revelation chapter 12.
Right.
The children of the devil.
Right. Exactly.
Yahweh's not going to pull a whale out of the ocean and punish it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just ridiculous.
That's right. Right. Yeah. The metaphor is obviously speaking about the race of serpent people.
Well, right. And this verse proves that that seed of the serpent in
right.
Genesis chapter 3 is in the sea. And it's in the sea today.
Yeah,
in
the people, mixed in with our people. Exactly. Verse 2. In that day, sing you to her a vineyard of red wine. Okay, so I don't know why. The red, of course.
Well, I'll tell
red.
You why. A vineyard of red wine.
Mm-hmm.
That's Revelation chapter 14.
Okay.
And I'm going to use this as an opportunity to exposit a serious King James mistranslation there.
Okay.
All right, because in Revelation chapter 14 there's an angel, and let me read it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to get exactly the right spot in angel 14.
Yeah, and
here's
this vineyard, tree, branch, root, this language, you know, speaking of people as plants, okay? There's simply no doubt that the Bible considers, you know, speaks of races of people as plants. So it's throughout the entire Bible, okay? So why isn't it possible in Genesis chapter 3 that the trees, especially the tree of the knowledge of both good and evil, is that evil seed, that evil race? That's exactly what it's talking about, okay?
Well, exactly. And there's, in Revelation 14, there's two harvests.
Okay.
And two angels. And there's an angel in Revelation 14, verses 14 and 15. And the King James takes a word which means parched and translates it ripe.
Okay.
And then there's another angel harvesting the earth in Revelation 14, verses 17 through 19. And there's a word translated ripe in the King James that really does mean ripe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So what you have where the King James, it looks like one harvest with two angels working on the same harvest. It's really two different harvests.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
And the first harvest, okay, and in verses 14 and 15 is the harvest of the parched. Okay?
Okay.
Swing your scythe and reap. Because the hour to reap has come, because parched, zer amputus, that word zerus means parched.
Mm-hmm.
And the King James translated that ripe.
Right. Okay.
And then there's a word that means ripe in trugalos in the next section with the next angel, and the King James correctly translated that ripe.
Okay.
But they really dropped the ball.
Right.
The first harvest is the harvest of the parched.
Right.
And that's the gathering of the tares.
Right.
And then the next harvest is the harvest of the ripe.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the vineyard of red wine here.
Okay.
And that day sing ye unto her a vineyard of red wine.
Yeah, so
the
so
tares,
this wine
Leviathan has been punished.
Yes.
The serpent has been punished. The parched have been harvested. The tares have been gathered. It's the same all the way through Scripture,
right.
Every time it talks
right.
about it.
Yeah, there's no reason why to deviate from the symbolism. Exactly.
Scripture is absolutely consistent.
Yes.
And the Jews that translate it are not.
So the red wine is basically the wine of the Adamites.
Well, right, and that's the second harvest of Revelation.
Right.
Chapter 14, verses 17 through 19.
Yes, very good. And, of course, in the same order, in 27 verses 1 and 2, we have the serpent being destroyed, and then the vineyard of red wine producing its fruits, okay? Verse 3, I, Yahweh, do keep it. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. The vineyard is Israel, okay? That's our race. Verse 4, fury is not in me. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle?
The briars and thorns are the other races.
Right.
And the Jews and the Arabs and everybody that's not an Adamite.
Right, right.
And that's also, you know, that's that plant, tree, race symbology again.
Yeah, and I would go through them, I would burn them together. Or let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. Verse 6, he shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Very specific, we're talking about Israel. Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. my King James has a notation here. It says believers. Israel believers. Okay.
Well, right. I guess yeah, you know, I guess fruit doesn't mean
in
that
way,
Genesis chapter 3, though.
What they're trying to imply here, this is like a Schofield note, is they're kind of like those Jews who now believe in Jesus Christ, in other words. Ain't happening, folks.
Well, right, but Isaiah wasn't talking about Jews. He was talking about Tyre.
Right.
He's still talking about Tyre, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, well, in this verse 6, it says, Israel shall blossom and bud, and will fill the face of the earth with fruit.
And that's what I mean. You know, those Israelites that were just
right.
went through this judgment will
right.
fill the face of the earth with
right.
fruit.
Yeah, and
that they did.
Right.
But none of them are Jews.
Right. Yeah, but they add the word believers here so because they know that the Jews aren't believers. So they're making an exception here. They're saying, well, this must mean Jewish believers.
Well, all three of them?
Well, in the word Israel as used in verse 6.
Yes.
Yeah, they make a notation here. It says, for example, Israel believers. Okay. So in other words, they're trying to reinterpret this verse to mean that the Jews who have accepted Jesus Christ shall blossom and bud.
Well, that's why I said all three of them. I mean, Jews haven't filled the face.
No, of course not. All three Jews, right.
And Jewish believers.
Well, there's 6 million. There's 6 million, Bill. Let's not, let's give them some credit.
You cannot by any means interpret this to mean Jews
right.
or Jewish
right.
believers.
But the King James, under the impression that the Jews are Israelites, have to insert this footnote. Try to make it sense for themselves. Okay?
Well, right, but and that just makes them look even stupider.
Right, exactly.
That's my point. All
mm-hmm.
three,
oh,
all
absolutely.
Three Jews for Jesus. I mean,
yes.
How 300
have to confuse
Jews
me
Jesus?
Too. Verse 7: Has he smitten him as he smote those that smote him, or is he slain according to the slaughter of them that are slain by him? In measure, when it shoots forth, you will debate with it. He stays his rough wind in the day of the east wind. By this, therefore, shall the iniquity of Jacob be purged. And this is all the fruit to take away his sin, when he makes all the stones of the altar as chalk stones that are beaten in sunder, the groves and images shall not stand up. So this imagery is obviously end times imagery. I would think that if a Judeo-Christian even bothered to read these verses, certainly a New Testament Christian wouldn't be interested in even trying to understand these verses. But this is not the sin that was taken away at the cross. We're talking about sinful Israel in the last days. That's the whole context of these chapters here. Okay, and the images shall, and we've established all kinds of images. American Idol, money, wealth, fame and fortune, everything that we're counseled not to idolize.
Well, first we were lied to, we're lied to about what an idol is.
Right.
And most people think that, they have this very narrow definition of what an idol is.
Mm-hmm.
An idol is a little statue that you set up and you pray to.
Right.
That's not true.
Like voodoo.
So they get this false mistake that the only idols in America are the statues in the Catholic Church.
Right.
Yeah, and basically America is replete with idolatry.
That's right.
But we are probably the most idolatrous nation since Sodom and Gomorrah.
Right.
And most of our idolatry is in our sports stadiums and on our television.
Yep. Yeah, and there's a verse, I don't know if it's in Isaiah or Ezekiel or Jeremiah, that talks about idolatry of the heart. Okay. That doesn't have any statues. That's in your mind, okay? Your idols are in your mind. Whatever you worship, if you put anything else above Yahweh, then you're engaging in idolatry. And, of course, Judaism is total idolatry because the rabbis teach that they are more intelligent than Yahweh.
Well, I've known guys with kids,
mm-hmm.
guys with children, that work all week, Monday through Friday,
mm-hmm.
and come home and spend all day Saturday polishing their sports cars.
Right.
Well, what about your kids? That sports car is their idol.
Yeah, right.
There's no doubt.
What about your faith? I guess there is no faith, right? Verse 10, yet the defenced city shall be desolate, and the habitation forsaken, and left like a wilderness. There shall the calf feed, and there shall he lie down, and consume the branches thereof. Okay, so there will be made a wilderness, and... we're getting ready to face that wilderness, folks. Verse 11, when the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. The women come and set them on fire, for it is a people of no understanding. Therefore, he that made them will not have mercy on them, and he that formed them will show them no favor. Why? Because they have no understanding. and they have no intention to understand. What did Jesus say? They have their reward. I mean, if having a hot car, a three-car garage, and a 10-room house is all you want out of existence, and that makes you happy, well then, okay, you have your reward. But what we're finding out here is that all that's going to be taken from you because you do not appreciate your Creator. Okay, verse 12. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river to the stream of Egypt, and you shall be gathered one by one, O you children of Israel. I see we only have about 10 minutes left. Let me say that this verse, verse 12, proves there's not going to be any massive conversion of Jews in the end times. No massive conversion of anybody.
No, that's a ridiculous thought. That entire theology is invented by Jews so that they can run cover for themselves.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, oh, we can do all the sin and all the crime and all the perverted things we want, and don't worry, we'll get away with it because we're all going to convert the next to last day.
Right.
And Christians fall for that.
They fall for
that garbage.
And, you know, in other words, the Christians look the other way while the Zionists slaughter innocent Palestinians, milk us of everything we own.
How about like taking hundreds of thousands of white women from Eastern Europe into sex slavery?
Right, and butchering people for their organs.
How about basically running the pornography and gambling industries here in America?
And Christians look the other way because they believe they're going to be raptured, and so they don't worry about it. Talk about stiff-necked Israelites, folks. Stiff-necked Israelites. Let me read this verse again, because this verse is so important. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river to the stream of Egypt, and that this can be interpreted to mean that Israelites will no longer come from that area, and you shall be gathered one by one, not in flocks, one by one. And that's what we see happening in Christian identity today. There's not a massive influx of people into this movement. It's one by one. People are waking up one at a time. O you children of Israel, verse 13. And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcast in the land of Egypt, and shall worship in Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem. Now, of course, this is talking about our history.
Well, this is talking about the children of the Assyrian deportation.
Right.
And the ones that fled to Egypt.
Right.
So this is
It's talking about us.
This is talking about a recovery of Israel from the lands of deportation. The Jews denied that any Israelites ever survived that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So that, I think, will take care of tonight's show. Is there a lurker in the chat room? I haven't been. I've been focusing on the scriptures here. I'm not seeing anything. Oh, okay. Yeah, he's making a funny. Okay. He wouldn't choose a name like Satan if he weren't one, right? Okay, ladies and gentlemen. So, obviously, the Satanists, the Shaitans of this world, like to insinuate themselves into our company. And that's the story of Genesis 3:14 and 3:15. They will not leave us alone. Okay? Wherever we go, the Jews follow at our heels and wait for a chance to bite.
There's no doubt. They agitate us.
That's right.
And when we have adversaries, when white Christians have adversaries, we usually ignore them and they go away.
Yeah.
But it's the Jewish methodology to chase after them and pester them
right.
to death.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because, for number one, the land will not yield for them. They do not engage in trades that construct cities and towns and civilizations. So they have no choice but to follow us around because they feed off of us like parasites. They really have no choice. Because whether they have no inclination to really work, or whether they're just not capable of building anything. Because obviously, mentally, they're inclined only to exploit, not to build. Okay? So with this satanic exploitative mentality.
Exploit and persecute. That's their two their two noblest traits.
Right. Well, they pretend to be God's chosen people. I mean, it's really quite incredible that they can get away with everything they've gotten away with. But the fact is, and if they hadn't been able to bribe preachers, you know, the televangelists, virtually the entire evangelical world, the Catholic Church for a part of history did oppose them, but now they're under the satanic umbrella too. There isn't a denomination, a mainstream denomination around that doesn't either directly worship them or follow them because they don't know what else to do, okay? They're working for Satan. They're working for the devil. As Paul prophesied in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, a great delusion will come across all of Christendom. And only the remnant, only the wise, according to Daniel chapter 12, only the wise shall understand. The rest shall not understand. So, folks, again, as Bill just said, Scripture is consistent from beginning to end. We're not the ones inventing any new theology. We're the ones that are being consistent from Old Testament to New Testament, and they tell us that we're wrong, okay, that we're inventing a new religion. That's what they're telling us. But the reality is that their religion has only been on the planet for the last 100 years or so. They're just on the planet, you know, these new Judeo-Christian religions I'm talking about, that have been fomented by the likes of Schofield and the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, the National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches, and all these phony religious organizations. That's what we've got, folks. And virtually every major denomination is part of those international satanic organizations. It's just that simple, okay? Yeah, Satan will be raptured. To hell, exactly. Okay, very good. This Isaiah is really great stuff. The prophetic nature of Isaiah is really fantastic. And a lot of the historical stuff that we went through last week and week before, we need to understand that so in order to understand the prophecies. Okay, and if we don't understand the history of our own people, we'll never understand what's really happening in this world. So thank you, Bill, for helping me explain these verses. We've got, 60, how many verses? 60 chapters, 60-some-odd verses, chapters in Isaiah.
We're not quite halfway. Another week we'll be halfway through.
Yeah, so, but it's going well. I think we're comprehending.
It's going to get better.
The prophetic stuff in Isaiah is just awesome. It's absolutely awesome, yeah. Okay, very good. Satan's trying to lurk back in, but we're going to go ahead and call it a night. Bill, thank you very much for joining me once again. This is great fun. We're learning so much from the Holy Scriptures, folks. I just wish we could say what we're saying in church. But if we say these things in church, they'll throw us out, right?
Okay. Absolutely.
Yes.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Thank you all for listening. Good night, and Yahweh bless everybody.